We hoped, obviously, in 1945 that warfare was going to be abolished, that humankind was going to be able to turn a new leaf and we'd be able to discover aspects of the human condition, which meant that we didn't need war. But unfortunately, since then, there have been 140 major wars, killing many, many millions of people.
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, Andrew Roberts talks about the importance of learning lessons from conflict and what we can expect from the conflicts of tomorrow.
What we're going to see in wars of the future are drones fighting against other drones. They're going to be shooting each other out of the sky, essentially.
As an award-winning Napoleon biographer, Lord Roberts shares his thoughts on the recent Hollywood blockbuster.
Sir Ridley Scott seems to hate historians. He's on record as saying, "Effing historians, what do they know? They weren't there." Which is so magnificently moronic remark to make, considering of course we weren't there, but hundreds of people were there.
Welcome to British Thought Leaders, I'm Lee Hall. I'm sitting down today with Andrew Roberts, Britain's leading military historian and member of the House of Lords. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
No, great to be on the show, Lee.
Your new book, Conflict, The Evolution of Warfare from 1945 to Ukraine, is out. The Wall Street Journal called it a new benchmark in the study of modern war. So we've been looking at this since Sun Tzu, but why is it important to study and understand war?
Because, as Leon Trotsky said, you might not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. We hoped, obviously, in 1945 that warfare was going to be abolished, that humankind was going to be able to turn a new leaf and we'd be able to discover aspects of the human condition, which meant that we didn't need war. But unfortunately, since then, there have been 140 major wars, killing many, many millions of people. And so it's our duty, really, to understand it.
What's the single biggest change in the face of conflict in the time period you're covering?
Oh, there have been so many. But, of course, weaponry has changed enormously. We've seen this, of course, in the Ukraine war with drones. They're going to change the whole face of the battlefield, but also with space and cyber, AI, robotics, you name it. You know, it's all changing immensely. In fact, it's changing faster now than ever before as well. The pace of technological change is bigger. Also, you know, occasionally people will say, look, the tank is obsolete. People did say that at the time of the Yom Kippur War 50 years ago, of course. But they're also saying that now because of the extraordinary anti-tank weaponry that we're seeing in Ukraine as well. So it's constantly changing. The interesting thing about it that David Petraeus and I recognised is that the evolution of warfare is not linear. It can get shunted into sidings, essentially, for sometimes for years.
Could you help us understand a bit the importance of technological advancement when it comes to war?
The overall concepts, strategic and tactical concepts, have stayed very much the same. And it's indeed years earlier than the Second World War. They're pretty much the same since the Napoleonic period. You try to outmaneuver your enemy. You try to get round his flank. You try to get him from behind, and so on. What's really making the huge those are the same, essentially. What's really making the huge difference is the weaponry with which you can do that. A classic example, for example, would be the Hamas tunnels in Gaza at the moment, which would allow the Hamas terrorists to get behind the Israeli Defense Forces and cause an awful lot of trouble, which requires, therefore, the Israeli Defense Forces to have large amounts of men directly behind the front line to make sure that doesn't happen.
So you've got a list of glowing praise for this book from the great and good of the military circles. And reading through them, one recurring theme I noticed is the idea of learning lessons from history. I wanted to know what are the key lessons this book is teaching us.
Well, one of them is the importance of strategic leadership. We very much discovered that the more we wrote the book, the more we recognised that you can lose a war even though you start off with all the cities, with four or five times the number of men, with better equipment and so on, if you don't have the right strategic leadership. And what we did really was to boil that down to four things. The first thing is you've got to get the big idea right about the campaign. You've got to understand the nature of the war. Clausewitz, of course, tells us that, but nonetheless, it's an absolute prerequisite. Then you've got to be able to explain that to your lieutenants and everybody, in fact, across the length and breadth of the organisation, to explain the big idea, what you're going to do. And then you have to implement it, of course, and change it, constantly update it throughout the course of the campaign. And those people who are able to do that, and of course it has to come to from the very top, the civil military leadership, those people who are able to do that can win. And people who don't do that almost always lose, regardless of how they started off the war in terms of men and material.
Sounds like something I've read in some of the ancient Chinese novels. The war is not necessarily won by who's got the biggest army, but who's got the best strategic commander.
Sun Tzu talks about this, of course, exactly. And as I say, Clausewitz. And one assumes that that might just be true of their time. But it's not. It's what we discovered is it's absolutely still true of wars post-1945. A classic example, for example, would be the Chinese Civil War of 1946-49. Chiang Kai-shek and his Kuomintang nationalist forces started off that war with five times the number of troops of the communist insurgency, all of the major cities, pretty much, and weaponry that they'd taken off the surrendering Japanese. So they had the latest kit, you know. And yet they lost the war, partly because Chiang Kai-shek didn't have the big idea right. He wanted to hang on to cities, and that's not actually the way to have fought that war. You needed to take on the Maoist insurgents in the countryside and in the jungles and so on. The other thing was that he wasn't able to get his lieutenants to follow his orders because you had these local warlords who essentially ignored what he was telling them.
You wrote this book with General Petraeus. You're a leading military historian. General Petraeus is a leading battlefield commander. And what did the collaboration bring to the book?
Well, I think exactly that. I was asked by the publishers how we were going to split the chapters between us. And I said, well, David's going to write about all the countries he's invaded, and I'm going to fill in the rest. And David also did the Vietnam chapter as well. And then we sent the chapters backwards and forwards to each other with literally thousands of emails between us. And it turned out to be a really intellectually stimulating exercise, as you can imagine, because, yes, I was putting forward the historical examples, but he was the man who commanded the coalition forces at the time of the surge in Iraq and also, of course, in Afghanistan.
Can you talk to us a bit about where you expect war to go in the future and what the coming generations of conflict will be like?
Well, I think Ukraine, although it does show lots of hints and signposts about future war, is not the template for future war were Russia to attack the Baltic states, for example.
Right.
Because that would bring in NATO, and NATO has got an awful lot of kit that it frankly hasn't given the Ukrainians, or at least not yet, and which would be pretty devastating to Russian forces if they were to attack. Then, of course, you have Taiwan. What happens there if the deterrence fails? A really important theme in this book is that deterrence is vitally important, of course. And also money spent on deterrence is virtually never wasted, because the amount of money that you have to spend on a war is always a massive multiple of the amount that you should have spent on deterring that war. But if the Chinese were to invade Taiwan, it would be devastating for the world economy and so on.
So you mentioned drones earlier. Do you think things like that would make a big difference as well?
Hugely, yes. What we're going to see in wars of the future are drones fighting against other drones. They're going to be shooting each other out of the sky, essentially. And that's also going to be true of jet fighters. The human is not going to be in a jet fighter of the future because the reactions of the human are, even in those incredibly quick reactions that the fighter pilots have, are too slow for a compared to the computers that are going to be running these and flying these planes. And so you're going to see the human come out of the loop. He's no longer going to be in the loop. He's going to be on the loop because, of course, he's going to be writing the algorithms that decide the what the machines do. But in the future, robotics and AI and so on are going to dominate the battlefield. This has positive and negatives. Obviously, the positive side, if you're on the cutting edge of the technology, is that you're likely to do better because robots don't get tired. They don't get. They don't have sympathy. They don't have cowardice. They don't have pity. But at the same time, there are negative sides to all of that, needless to say.
Since your book covers the period up to Ukraine, since then we've had Hamas attacking Israel, unprecedented protests here in Britain. Do you think we're seeing another new chapter to the study of conflict there?
Well, we're actually seeing a literal new chapter because I'm going to be writing the chapter for the paperback when it comes out next year. So yes, it is, of course, a new chapter. I think the sheer savagery of the 7th of October attack on the civilians in southern Israel was a tactical manoeuvre. It was obviously designed to create the kind of horrific scenes that we've seen. They wouldn't be wearing the GoPro without that. You know, they must have known that some were going to be captured, some were going to be taken. And so... That's a new sort of departure in warfare. Not the savagery. The savagery, of course, you see in the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages and so on. But the idea that a terrorist group wants everybody to see these unbelievably vicious and loathsome and repulsive images is a sort of new low in the history of post-war terrorism, in my view.
It's also social media is playing a role in this conflict that I've never really seen before either.
It is, and a very bad one, essentially, because there's something about human nature that we want to sort of indulge in the darkest recesses of the soul, and that's what I think one sees in certain things that are going around TikTok, for example, and indeed just the sheer number of pro-Palestinian TikTok posts compared to the pro-Israeli ones. They seem to be outnumbering them 10-1, even though, of course, it was Israel that was attacked, and Israelis and Jews who were subjected to quite unbelievable tortures and humiliating deaths.
You've written extensively on the Second World War. A recent article of yours about why Hamas are worse than the Nazis generated quite a lot of debate. Mm. I wonder if you could talk us through the argument behind that.
Well, of course, I wasn't arguing that they were quantitatively worse than the Nazis. Obviously, 6 million speaks for itself as a figure that is quantitatively far worse than anything that Hamas has managed to do up till now. But qualitatively, they are worse because the Nazis attempted to destroy the gas chambers, to hide the scenes of their and the evidence of their monstrous crimes. Whereas, as I mentioned, Hamas are pleased to let everyone know. Rape was, of course, endemic in the Second World War, but it was at least officially opposed. You know, it was something that the officer corps of the Wehrmacht did not actually give orders to do, whereas Hamas seemed to have actually encouraged the rape and sexual humiliation of women on a huge scale. Hostage taking was done by the Nazis, of course, especially as a way of keeping local populations down. You know, you essentially captured, took as a hostage the mayor, the sometimes the cleric, the top businessman in a town or a village, and threatened to shoot them if there were reprisals against German soldiers. But not 9-month-old babies, you know, or old ladies in wheelchairs or that kind of thing. I mean, that for Hamas, again, is an extraordinary new low that is something that even the most vicious anti-Semites that we've had in history up till now, the Nazis, did not indulge in. And there are plenty of others. I go in that article that you kindly mentioned that was published in the Washington Free Beacon, I go into various other areas, you know, and as you say, it has promoted a good deal of debate, and but so far I haven't seen any history that proves that I'm wrong. And lots of people have got their own opinions, obviously, but as far as history is concerned, I think it stacks up.
Changing the subject somewhat, your biography of Napoleon is one of the most celebrated accounts of the historical figure. It's even required reading in Silicon Valley these days. The new Napoleon film portrays him as a brutal, somewhat ill-mannered dictator who kind of relies on his wife to, or his partner to do things. I mean, what are your thoughts on the film's portrayal of Napoleon?
I think it's a great shame, really. Some $300 million was spent on that movie. If it had been a little closer to the truth, in fact, which is, as always, the historical truth is stranger than the fiction, I think it would have been a much better movie. But unfortunately, Sir Ridley Scott seems to hate historians. He's on record as saying, effing historians, what do they know? They weren't there. Which is so magnificently moronic remark to make, considering, of course, we weren't there, but hundreds of people were there in the reign of Napoleon, who wrote about it and who are able to speak to us across the centuries and tell us what happened and what didn't happen. And so when Ridley Scott has Napoleon charging, leading cavalry charges and firing guns at the pyramids and things like that, what he really should have done was instead try to explain to the viewer why Napoleon was somebody who inspired such such adulation. And the figure played by Joachim Phoenix, it strikes me, is just a sort of boorish dolt who nobody would follow for any reason at all.
If we take a wider look at society, there's probably just as many people getting their ideas of history from movies, TV shows, than from books. Are films like this in danger of rewriting our history to some degree?
Oh, they certainly are, but they always have been. You know, Hollywood has established a sense about various people in history for years, and of course they are. It's inaccurate, but nonetheless, you know, these aren't documentaries. They're entertainment vehicles, and one can't expect everybody to pile their way through my very long life of Napoleon. Although I am thankful that since the Scott movie came out, it's now selling at 10 times the rate that it was before the movie, so every cloud. But you're right, no, I mean, people will, I'm afraid, now, probably for another generation till the next Napoleon movie, think of him as this sort of ill-tempered, brooding figure who, you know, has sex with his wife under the table when the servants are present, and is quite unlike the actual man himself, who had a very good sense of humour and, of course, was a great reformer who changed France and Europe very fundamentally. None of this do you get out of Ridley Scott's movie.
Churchill spoke very highly of Napoleon. He's a figure that's receiving this rewriting of his history, probably even more so. And I know you've written about Churchill. Can you talk to us a bit about this kind of rewriting of Churchill that's taking place?
Well, I think the difference between the rewriting of Churchill and the rewriting of Napoleon is that you know, there's nobody alive today who knew Napoleon, whereas there are plenty of people who who at least knows somebody who knew somebody who knew Winston Churchill. And there's also, up and down the land, there are people who can tell their grandchildren about what an inspiring figure Winston Churchill was. So this is a problem that the revisionists have when they try to make Churchill out to be a monster and a villain, as the deputy leader of the Labour Party said a couple of years ago, as a sort of evil figure, essentially, a sort of sinister figure. Actually, there are loads of people who are able to stand up and say, no, that's not what happened. In fact, he was the man who got the Nazis right, gave us the strategy to win the Second World War, saw the communist threat, and was the first person to warn against that as well, and indeed the threat before the First World War. So we actually, there are many more people who know that Winston Churchill was a great man. The major line of attack on him, obviously, is that he was a racist. Mm. And he was born in 1874. He was born when Charles Darwin was still alive. You know, he, in fact, in his career, did an enormous amount to help non-white people in the empire. But that's not the thing that's ever noticed. The thing that's noticed is the racist jokes that he made and various, you know, racist remarks, which to modern ears sound terrible. And if we are going to judge everybody in the past entirely and solely by our own mores, then there will be nobody in history who will come out well, and worse than that, we ourselves will be judged by mores that we can't even grasp at now, and in 100 years' time they'll be pulling down our statues for reasons that mean nothing to us.
What can we do to kind of keep history on the right track here and keep referring to the proper sources, etc.?
Stick to the evidence. Stick to the evidence. Be as objective as you can be. Take it for granted that there will be people who are trying to use history for rather gross political reasons, but call it out when you see it's wrong. And I think if you have enough of that, and obviously enough good historians who are appointed at universities completely regardless of politics, then ultimately, truth will out. It's luckily, there's a very good organisation that does this called History Reclaimed, which has got a first-class website. It has a lot of really good historians who, when they see something completely sort of politically biased and unhistorical, sometimes ahistorical, they write articles and put them on History Reclaimed. So I do recommend to your viewers to take a look at that website, because actually it does really sort of explode an awful lot of the myths that are being put out there.
Andrew Roberts, thank you for joining us on British Thought Leaders.
Thank you very much, Lee. I've much enjoyed it.